Good morning. My name is Emily Manns, and I am pleased to welcome you here to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum to hear today's speaker, Dr. Cameron Wake. But before we get started, please join me in thanking our musician today, August Waters. Also, our local business sponsor, Southpac Solar, and the provider of our beautiful flowers, Rosalie's Garden. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. Today's talk is being recorded and will be available as a podcast on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, within a few days. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported primarily through contributions of our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations. Our speaker today is Dr. Cameron Wake. Cameron Wake is a research professor at the Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space at the University of New Hampshire. He is the program chair for the Sustainability Dual Major and is the Josephine A. Lamprey Professor in Climate and Sustainability at the UNH Sustainability Institute. He leads a research program investigating regional climate change and is a leader in Climate Solutions New England, a collaborative effort to secure healthy, prosperous, and sustainable communities through the pursuit of integrated solutions that include energy self-reliance and weather resilience. Dr. Wake is an author of over 75 scientific papers and peer-reviewed reports. In recognition of his engaged scholarship around the issue of climate change, Dr. Wake was awarded the UNH Faculty Award of Excellence in Public Service in 2010. Dr. Wake received a Bachelor of Science in Geology from the University of Ottawa in Canada, and a Master's of Geography from Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario. He completed his PhD in Earth Sciences in 1993 from the University of New Hampshire, where he has spent his distinguished and influential career in climate science and the evolving field of energy sustainability. And I would just like to say that Cameron just told me that his wife, Selena Adams, is also in the audience, and we'd like to wish them a happy 26th wedding anniversary. So, So please join me in a warm welcome for today's Monadnock Summer Lyceum speaker, Dr. Cameron Wake.
Well, thank you for that warm introduction, Emily, and thank you for having me here today. It's a real honor to speak to you today about what is a topic that is close to my heart. I want to begin my comments today on climate change with the premise that human-driven climate change is the single greatest challenge that humanity faces over the course of the 21st century, and likely a challenge that will continue in centuries to follow. While there certainly are other grand challenges, I see climate change as the most significant challenge because it makes it difficult to impossible to address those other challenges. For example, childhood hunger and lack of food security, both in this country and around the world, is certainly a grand challenge. And that challenge is made more difficult by climate change as extreme heat and drought and extreme rainstorms serves to reduce food production, especially in the tropics where the majority of humanity lives. National security and reducing conflict around the globe is certainly a grand challenge, and a challenge made more difficult by climate change. A suite of recent Pentagon reports has called climate change a threat multiplier that aggravates stresses such as poverty, environmental degradation, political instability, and social tensions that help fuel conflict. Immigration, illegal or otherwise, has also been in the news lately, and has frequently been labeled as a significant national security challenge by some. The potential migration of tens to hundreds of millions of people due to climate change, now with its own name, climate migration, will make our current immigration challenges pale in comparison. preserving biodiversity and critical ecosystems that provide us with clean air and clean water and pollination and rich soil and food and timber and oxygen and much more is a serious challenge. We are already experiencing what has been called by scientists a sixth great extinction, due in part to the fact that our climate is changing at a rate faster than species or ecosystems can move or adapt. And improving public health is certainly a grand challenge, and a challenge that will be made more difficult as climate change results in extreme heat waves, more air pollution, more pollen, more floods, and the wider spread of disease by mosquitoes and ticks. There's plenty of other grand challenges: women's rights, terrorism, sustainable development, economic opportunity, all of which will be made more challenging as a result of human-driven climate change. With that as a background, I want to share three perspectives on the issue of climate change with you. Three perspectives that I hope will propel you and propel us to action. First, climate changes. It always has changed and always will change. The only difference today is that there is an extensive and overwhelming body of scientific evidence that shows that humans are the main drivers of our climate today. And once you accept that, once you understand that, the following is true. The future climate is literally in our hands. The climate that our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren inherit depends fundamentally on the decisions we make today and over the next decade about how we produce and how we use energy. Second, with every challenge comes opportunity. And I believe that climate change is the innovation opportunity of the 21st century. And I mean innovation across a wide spectrum of society. We need to transition from the tyranny of or to the opportunity of and. We need to innovate across technology and capital investments and preserving priceless ecosystems and our social structures and networks and our education systems and the way that academics actually engage with society. And we need to do this to preserve our ecosystems and to provide economic opportunity and to expand social and environmental justice. Third, climate change is a moral imperative. If you've been paying attention, you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that it is those who are most vulnerable who are going to suffer the most in a world driven by human climate change. You really need look no further than Hurricane Katrina, Superstorm Sandy, Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Irma, or Hurricane Maria to realize that it is those who are young, those who are old, those who are sick, and those who are poor who suffer the most. That's not the only perspective on vulnerability, though. When Celine and I drove over here today from the seacoast, we emitted a bunch of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That carbon dioxide is going to be in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. I get all the benefit, but I am pushing the impacts of that carbon dioxide on future generations, which I think is also really not morally defensible. In addition, native cultures are beginning to ask, and with good reason, why should we pay for your way of life? We need to act now to reduce the impact of climate change on those who are most vulnerable, on future generations, and on those whose entire cultures are most at risk. All right, with that as a background, I want to dive into a little bit of the science on climate change, and then we'll finish up talking about sort of a range of solutions that I think that we need to pursue. So I want to take some time to share what I would call a few seminal records of climate change that really speak to the broader change in the Earth's climate system. And I think a systems approach is actually fundamental for actually understanding what a huge risk climate change is. I am by training an ice core paleoclimatologist. I travel around the world and recover ice cores and reconstruct how climate has changed. And one of the most important records that we have on climate change is an ice core that comes from Antarctica. This is not an ice core that I worked on, but it's an ice core that the scientific community has spent decades working on. and it tracks climate change for over 800,000 years. And the bubbles that get trapped in glacial ice as that snow transitions from fern to ice actually provide an almost perfect archive for scientists to come back, as we have, right, 800,000 years later, and drill that core, crush that ice, and actually measure the trace gas content of the atmosphere and how it's changed over time. And in this case, we've measured the concentration of heat-trapping gases, carbon dioxide, and methane. So why do you care about those? Because they trap long-wave radiation coming from the Earth. We have short-wave radiation coming from the sun. It serves to heat up the Earth. The more of methane and carbon dioxide that we have in the atmosphere, the more that traps actually the long-wave radiation coming out from the Earth. If that's complicated, just think about a blanket that you put on your bed on a cold New Hampshire night. That's trapping long-wave radiation coming from your body. Greenhouse gases, heat-trapping gases are doing the same thing in the atmosphere. So, two key points. The content of carbon dioxide and methane closely tracks that of global temperatures. When there's an increase in the atmospheric content of heat-trapping gases, there's an increase in temperature, and vice versa. This close relationship between the Earth's the concentration of heat-trapping gases in the Earth's atmosphere and the Earth's temperature has been synchronous over the course of the past 800,000 years as we've gone through eight glacial-interglacial cycles. More greenhouse gas, warmer temperatures. Less greenhouse gas, lower temperatures. And this record is as beautiful to a climate scientist as a Mozart symphony or the Boston Red Sox winning the World Series might be to you. The second is that before human beings started burning fossil fuels for energy, carbon dioxide was never higher than 300 parts per million by volume. So I want you to remember that number. Because that brings us to the second seminal record of climate change. And that's the current measurements of carbon dioxide that are being performed around the world, but the longest record is from Mauna Loa in Hawaii. They began in 1957 by the now famous Charles Keeling, who was then at Scripps. In 1961, the year that I was born, atmospheric carbon dioxide peaked at Mauna Loa at 320 parts per million. In May of this year, the peak was 412 parts per million by volume. The increase in carbon dioxide that we have observed since I was born, on the order of 90 parts per million by volume, is equivalent to the shift that we see in carbon dioxide change from a glacial to an interglacial age. Those two records alone tell us that humans have had a profound effect on the Earth's climate system. And we know that that carbon dioxide increase in the atmosphere is coming from human activities because we've done a basic carbon budget and because a wealth of other scientific knowledge. And I'd be happy to share some details on that if you want to ask me more on that front. So we know that carbon dioxide has come primarily from the burning of fossil fuels. That has transformed our lifestyle, improved our quality of life. But that comes with a byproduct, because when we burn carbon, we oxidize it, carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere. But it's not only fossil fuels, it's also a result of our really clearing a lot of land to grow our food, and really our agricultural system is now on the order, provides on the order of about a quarter of the overall greenhouse gas content of the atmosphere. All right, third seminal record. Global temperatures have been steadily rising since 1970. In 2017, average global temperature was 1.7 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. 17 of the 18 warmest years on record since 1880 have occurred in the 21st century. We have now had 401 consecutive months that have recorded average temperatures that are higher than the average for the 20th century. Extensive research using global climate models clearly shows that this warming cannot be explained by any natural cycle, such as an increase in solar output or a decrease in volcanic eruptions. Rather, this warming has the distinct fingerprint of increasing content of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere from human activities. Fourth seminal record, Arctic sea ice has been declining, at least since we began mapping it in detail using satellites in 1979. Why do we care about Arctic sea ice? Because it's white. and it reflects incoming solar radiation right back out into space. When you eliminate that white sea ice cover, the sun actually hits the Arctic Ocean, which is dark and transparent. And so that energy is actually absorbed by the water and serves to heat up the Earth's climate system. Over the past four decades, September Arctic sea ice extent has decreased from 8 million square kilometers to 5 million square kilometers. So we have seen about a 40% decrease in the extent of Arctic sea ice at the end of the summer. Perhaps even more important, the amount of multi-year sea ice. So sea ice that is on the order of 40 to 50 feet thick. Think about the height of the ceiling in this wonderful room that we're in today. There's very little multi-sea ice left. It's really only 1 year old on the order to 10 to 15 feet thick. So that makes the Arctic very vulnerable to warm summers. And the scientists that study this in detail have suggested that Arctic sea ice in September will disappear in the next decade or two, and that's a threshold we have crossed, and we're not coming back from that because the Arctic Ocean is continuing to accumulate so much energy. And the fifth seminal record is that sea levels are continuing to rise, and the rate of that rise is increasing. We are now a little more than 3 millimeters per year of sea level rise. And sea level goes up really primarily for two reasons. One is because the water is getting warmer. In fact, the oceans have absorbed 90% of the energy in the Earth's system as a result of the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And that warmer water is less dense, so it takes up more volume, so it causes sea level to rise. The second reason is that we are transferring ice from the continent into the ocean. So this is, I'm not talking about sea ice, I'm talking about land-based glaciers and really big ice sheets. I wanted to add a couple of more numbers here. We've been measuring the observations of ice mass changes using GRACE satellites, so it's really hard to measure all of Antarctica from a snowmobile and walking around. You really have to use a satellite to measure it, just like you need to use satellites to measure sea ice. And over the course of the past 15 years, Antarctica has on average lost an annual mass of 125 gigatons. So a gigaton is a billion tons, and it's about the equivalent of 400,000 Olympic pools, right? That's one gigaton. So we've been losing 125 gigatons per year from Antarctica and about 280 gigatons of ice per year from Greenland. And that's enough to cause sea level to rise at about 1.1 millimeter per year. And what we're seeing is that contribution of sea ice from Antarctica and Greenland is actually increasing. All right, so what's been happening in New England over this time period? Well, we've examined the best available data that we have from weather stations called the Historical Climatology Network, and we've examined it for a whole range of trends. And I'm just going to share very briefly with you what's been happening. So over the past five decades, I'm sure you're probably aware of this if you've been paying attention, is the region has been warming. The most rapid rate of warming is occurring in minimum nighttime temperatures. And in fact, our winters have been more warming much more rapidly than any other season. In fact, our winters have increased on the order of 5 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit over the course of the past 50 years. So our winters are warming at twice their rate. More than twice the rate that the globe is warming. And I'm sure if you're a cross-country skier or a downhill skier, you've also noticed that we have far fewer snow-covered days than we used to in the past. Overall, we've seen our average annual precipitation go up slightly. I don't think that's necessarily bad. I think New England is blessed with a wealth of fresh water. Unfortunately, more of that rain is coming in fewer events. So we're seeing many more extreme precipitation events. One example I can provide you, 50 years ago, Durham got one precipitation event that dropped more than 4 inches of rain in a decade. In the last decade of record, we received 10 of those events. So that, combined with the fact that especially in, well, in this region as well, in the seacoast, we're seeing an increase in population and an increase in impervious cover. That has really driven this significant increase in the amount of flooding that we're experiencing in the southern part of the state. It's a combined climate change and development signal. What else? We're also continuing to experience a rise in sea levels off the coast of New England on the order of about 7 inches every 100 years. So our sea levels are rising at about the same rate that the global average is rising. So that brings me to, what about the future? How is our climate going to change in the future? I want to come back to words that I started with that, wherein I said, the future climate is literally in our hands. So the future climate depends fundamentally on what we humans do in terms of our emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels or from our agricultural systems or from our land use policies. As climate scientists, we actually deal with that issue by looking at scenarios. So what I'm telling you is we cannot predict what the climate can be. We can only project what it will be given a scenario of how much greenhouse gas we put in the atmosphere. So we have examined statistically downscaled global climate model simulations from 29 different models that were run as part of the fifth assessment for the recently completed Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. There is tremendous detail in this information, and my colleague, Dr. Elizabeth Burakowski, and I are currently analyzing the output and working on a new climate assessment for New England that we expect will be completed this fall. But in short, the new analysis that we've done completely confirms the results from the last time we did this, from the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel Climate Change, when we only looked at the output from four different models. And it's pretty simple. New England is going to get warmer, and New England is going to get wetter. Depending on which global emission scenario we follow, by the period 2070 to 29, we can expect New England's average annual temperature will warm by somewhere in the range of 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Our average summertime temperatures will increase by 7 to 12 degrees Fahrenheit, putting us in a summertime climate somewhere between current Washington, D.C. and South Carolina. The number of 90 degrees Fahrenheit days is going to increase substantially on the order of 30 to 60. So we currently have less than 10 days that are warmer than 9 degrees Fahrenheit. By the end of the century, we'll have something on the order of 30 to 60, again, depending on which global emission scenario we follow. Winters will continue to warm. There will be fewer snow-covered days, and there will certainly be less opportunity for winter recreation. Along with that warming, we're going to see significant changes in our ecosystems. Our forests are going to change and likely transition from a mixed hardwood forest of maple, beech, and birch to one that's dominated by hickory and oak, with likely the loss of much of our evergreen forest, except in the very northern reaches of Maine. How fast that transition will happen is actually anybody's guess. The trees are not going to get up and start walking, but we are going to begin to see this significant change. And we're going to see an increase in the number of pests, as well as the number of diseases that are carried by mosquitoes and ticks across our region. And extreme precipitation events will continue to increase in frequency and magnitude. And I think that is likely to be the single largest issue that we need to deal with outside of coastal New Hampshire, is that increase in floods, because historically, much of our settlement has been, just like Peterborough, in valley bottoms. And so as we see those larger extreme precipitation events combined with development across the landscape, we can expect to see more flooding. And sea levels are going to continue to rise for centuries. How much sea levels rise will depend fundamentally on how large the tidewater glaciers that drain Greenland and West Antarctica respond to continued warming. This is a rapid and rapidly evolving area of scientific research, and the sense is that both Greenland and West Antarctica are extremely vulnerable to the warming that we're seeing, and they could end up disintegrating much more rapidly than our models currently suggest they do. But expert opinion suggests that sea levels will rise in the range of 2 to 8 feet by 2100, and that's something that we better start getting used to and responding to. All right, so the final part. What are we going to do about it? In terms of climate science and solutions, we really sort of look at two different sets of actions. We look at mitigation, which in climate science is figuring out how we reduce the emissions of greenhouse gas to the atmosphere. And we think about adaptation, which is how we are going to adapt to the changes that we have already baked into the system, because the Earth's climate system is big and it's like a big flywheel and we're not going to slow it down that quickly. And the adaption really requires us to start thinking about how we're going to prepare for a different future and how it is we begin to build and enhance the resilience in our communities. I also want to say that a big part of what I do at the University of New Hampshire is really thinking about how we educate and mentor and enhance the future generation of leaders. So my generation and my parents' generation has not done a very good job on addressing this issue. And in fact, I would argue that we have kicked the can down the road. And what we really need to be doing is uplifting a whole range of diverse leadership amongst our youth so that they can really take the reins and begin to solve this challenge. All right, so I like fives, so I've come up with sort of five big picture items on what we need to do. And again, I want to emphasize that I think climate change is the innovation opportunity for the 21st century. There is tremendous opportunity in this challenge if we only have the individual and the community and the political will to move forward. I think we can get to a much better place, and one where we value sustainability and we value diversity much more than we do today. First and foremost, there's one thing we really need our federal government to do, and that's to put a price on carbon. It's really important that we send the signal to the energy markets that clean energy is valuable. And I just want to give a quick shout out to the Citizens Climate Lobby. I know there's several of you in the audience today who have been really working on a bipartisan approach to this issue. And there are now individuals and groups across the political spectrum that support this notion of a price on carbon or a carbon fee and dividend. Some people even use the tax word. It may sound obvious, but I have to say it, is that we have to promote energy efficiency and renewables. And I would argue, so that's on the mitigation side of the house, that mitigation is the most important adaptation strategy. So when I talk about mitigation and adaptation, you can envision them as two different things, but they are fundamentally linked. Because if we reduce the amount of greenhouse gas that we put in the atmosphere, we reduce the amount of climate change that we have to adapt to. It is a very simple equation. So we need to start thinking, as some cities around the nation have, of being net zero emitters by 2050. In fact, the trajectory that we are on in terms of global emissions, we have something on the order of 10 to 20 years at current rates of global emissions of greenhouse gases before we blow through the Paris climate commitment of trying to limit global warming to 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So we have to figure this out, we have to do it quickly, and individuals, institutions, municipalities, states need to start thinking about when they are going to get to net zero emissions. The third point is that we need to conserve key ecosystems, both because of the wonderful necessary services that they provide, and one of the most important being a carbon sink. And I can tell you that New England is a fantastic example of how we have brought back a vibrant ecosystem that now takes more carbon out of the atmosphere than it puts into the atmosphere. I'd also like to say that one of the I would say, most important movements over the course of the past 20 to 30 years in this regard has been private citizens teaming up with local and state and federal governments to preserve land across New England. We continue to be an example, I think, for the nation and the world in terms of our land preservation activities, now paid for with the majority of private funds. That needs to continue. I haven't spoken a lot about this, but our agricultural system does contribute about a quarter of the greenhouse gases to the atmosphere that are causing this problem. And we really need to figure out how to transition to a much lower carbon food system. That's going to come with some dietary changes, but it's also going to become with really increasing the efficiency of our agricultural system in terms of the amount of fossil fuels that we use, and also how much carbon we actually store in agricultural soils. And that transition is well underway in experimental plots with experimental farmers. I'm sure there's some of you here in the room, but that needs to go much more broadly across the nation and the world. And then The fifth, and perhaps one of the most challenging, is we really need to figure out how we can make our communities much more resilient to the climate change that we are going to inherit in the future. And that takes community action at a lot of different levels. So that's a lot of recommendations without a lot of specifics, and I don't have time to unpack all of those. So what I thought I'd do in my last few minutes here is let's just unpack a couple of those in sort of an integrated way. I do want to emphasize here that there is no silver bullet. There's no one technology. There's no one solution. There's no one government that's going to come along and say, we figured this out. What it's going to do is take hard work by all of us as individuals, in our communities, in our municipalities, in our states, and in our country, working together. It's going to be a lot of hard work. We need transformational change. If we do this, though, that transformational change, we will be in a much better place in the future, I think, than we are today, not only by stabilizing our climate system, but again, by really transitioning to a far more sustainable society. So first, I would ask you to examine the decisions that you are making, again, in your home, in your school, in your business, in your church, in your nonprofit, in your local and state government. It's really too late for piecemeal efforts. We really need this transformational change. And so every time a decision is made, you need to ask, is this going to serve to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? Is this going to build resilience in our community? Is this going to be socially just and environmentally just? It's not the only question to ask, but it needs to be part of the decision-making process. And it's not now and then or when you feel good about it. It's all the time. So just to give you an example, in our home, in we actually live in Kittery, Maine, even though I've been at the University of New Hampshire for 3 decades. When our boiler broke 4 years ago, we decided to install a wood pellet boiler. It cost a little bit more, but the fuel cost less. And really, one of the most glorious days of my life was when that stinky oil tank with number 2 heating fuel was removed from my basement, and my basement now smells of wood dust instead of number 2 oil. When we had the opportunity, we put solar panels on our roof. We took out our old electric water heater and we put in an air source water pump to heat our water. And then it was starting to get hot in Kittery, so we actually installed air source heat pumps to cool ourselves in summertime, but then to also heat in the shoulder season. So we use our solar panel energy to heat our house in the spring and the fall. At the University of New Hampshire, in terms of our institutions, we did a greenhouse gas emissions inventory back in 2000. And then at that time, we said, we need to be 50% below 2005 levels in 2020, and we need to be net zero shortly after that. At UNH, we sort of transformed the way we think about energy. About 10 years ago, we actually installed a pipeline that transports landfill gas from the Turnkey landfill. We process it, we take out the water and the carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide, and we now use that to heat and cool our campus in a combined heat and power station on campus. We also began something called the Energy Task Force, which to look across the university as ways that we could systematically improve our energy efficiency and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Municipalities and states play a really important role here, and they actually need to lead, because it's clear to me that our federal government has abdicated any leadership that they might have had on this issue. And that's where you're seeing climate leadership come from. This notion of adopting net zero policy, net zero emissions sometime in the near future. Communities need to pass ordinances to build resilience to climate change. And again, I think a lot of the focus needs to be on how do we keep development out of those areas that are most vulnerable to flooding? And as for those that infrastructure that is in those areas, how do we make it resilient to that flooding in the future? And we're doing a lot of work on that on the seacoast. I think it's really important to think about putting mitigation and adaptation plans into your master plan. We need to begin thinking about how our communities are going to change. And frankly, we really need to think about how we can convince our state politicians to start thinking in this systematic way to address the issue of climate change. So that was one big piece, right, in terms of an example, is really to examine the decisions that you're making. I get asked a lot is like, but what can I do individually on this issue? And here is what I really want you to think about. I want you to interrogate your investments. I want you to think about putting your money where your mouth is. It is no longer enough to invest in whatever and take that 5 to 7% return you do and do really good things with that money. It's just not enough. The only way that we can drive this transition in all these key systems that I'm talking about is if we invest our money in the future world that we want. So my friend Joe Keefe, who's now the head of Pax World Funds, and I were on a stage recently at the Music Hall, and he said something that really shocked me. He said, where you invest your money is probably more important than how you vote. What I want you to at least think about is spend as much time thinking about where your money is invested as the time you put in to who you vote for. The only way we can fund this revolution is if we do it with our money, because the Koch brothers aren't going to do it. The Exxon Mobils of the world are not going to do it. We need to do it. Just to transform our energy system to be primarily renewable and close to net zero, we're going to need $1 trillion per year for 30 years. That's $30 trillion. Right now, we're investing about $300 billion per year. Where's that other $700 billion going to come from? It's got to come from us. It's actually getting easier to do this. There's a whole number of large financial firms that now have these funds called ESG, Environmental, Social, and Governance. So it's not about a negative screen, it's about a positive screen. It's about investing in those companies that are actually driving the change. And I will provide a short shout out that my thinking on this front, because I'm a climate scientist, I am not an investor, has really been transformed by my wife, Selena, who actually advises people on both on their philanthropic giving as well as the investments that they make. And it's been a wonderful transition really over the course of the past 5 years to figure out that this is the source of money that we're going to need to transition. So I actually want to close today with a quote from Vivian Green. Life isn't about waiting for the storm to pass. It is about learning how to dance in the rain. Right? The storm is here. The rain is coming. And ignoring the problem is only going to make it worse, and it's going to put an even bigger burden on future generations. We need to learn how to dance in the rain. We need to innovate across society, and we need to do it together, one conversation and one decision at a time. So in summary, I actually want to take everything that I've just said over the last 40 minutes and put it into 12 words. Here's my take on climate change. It's real. It's us. Scientists agree. It's bad. We can fix it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.